Order, open a meeting of the Joint Special Committee on Land Use Fairness for Thursday, April 19, 2007. For the members of the public who are here, understand this is a work session this evening, so there will be no public testimony received. You're certainly welcome to watch the proceedings here this evening, but we would urge that you not make any expressions that could be distracting to the committee, because we've got to focus in on some important bill language here reflecting proposed changes to Measure 37. I would also urge that if, for any of you who have cell phones or pagers or other electronic devices, please turn them off. Putting them in the inactive or vibrate mode is not sufficient. We have very sensitive audio equipment here in the hearing rooms, and those are interfered with if you don't turn those off entirely. The purpose of this evening's meeting is to see for the first time bill language reflecting the framework that was has been developed by members of this committee and has been brought forward by the co-chairs. And that framework was presented a week ago in concept form, and then public testimony was taken on it on Tuesday on four different bills, but all focusing on the framework. And this evening, for the first time, we have bill language reflecting that framework, and it's practically still warm from the copier. So it's an opportunity for the members of the committee to get informed about the details of this proposal. So at this point, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1019, and we'll invite Richard Whitman and Lane Shetterly to come forward and to walk the committee members through the bill.
Mr. Chair. I think before we get started, the other thing I want to put on the record, since we are starting a little bit late, it's about 5:35. We had scheduled to start at 5. Unfortunately, the draft that we got, we did not receive it from the Legislative Council. That is who actually puts it in the bill form until 5:14. And so we then had to get copies made so everyone on the committee could get it, as well as those who got copies out in the audience. And it's one of those situations. Legislative Council is, let's say, very taxed at this time with all the work they have. As you can imagine, if you walk through the hallway right now, there's many committees that are meeting. There's a lot of demands. The other Monday, there was a request to have 95 amendments ready on that Monday. And so you can see that as much as we know this is very important to many, many people in this room and a very serious matter, there are a lot of other committees that are meeting with taking up very serious issues as well, and it's just unfortunate we have to wait our turn to get amendments. And so I know that they worked very hard in getting this out, and they're really unfortunately overtaxed for all of the work that we have to do in the legislature. So I am thankful that the Legislative Council's office was able to accommodate us so we can go forward.
Thank you, Co-Chair Przonski, and I'd like to add my appreciation to Legislative Council, who have been working very diligently and under a lot of time pressure to bring this project forward, but other projects as well. And so now we turn it over to Lane Shetterly and Richard Whitman.
Got my cleanances already for me. You're way ahead. That's good.
Co-Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, Richard Whitman from the Oregon Department of Justice. I've been tasked with walking you through the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1019 tonight. And I'm prepared to do that in a fair amount of detail, but also would welcome, as I go through this, if there are particular questions that committee members have about a particular section that I haven't addressed, please interrupt me and ask the question, as I know you will.
And Mr. Whitman, our sort of working approach is going to be to urge the committee members to hold their questions until you've had a chance to go through the bill entirely, so that we get the continuity of it, and then there'll be time available for the members to ask questions after that.
Knowing that you're going to be covering a lot of topics today instead of maybe having someone want to advance to a section that you have not reached, we thought it would be more consistent. We'll mark our questions, and then once we get through your presentation, come back in an orderly manner and maybe go back through each section for those that have questions.
All right. Chair McPherson, Senator Przonski, thank you. So with that, let me start with just a very quick overview of the bill and then start into particular sections. In terms of an overview, What this bill does is that it, and I did some of this other night, so I apologize for going back through this ground twice, but I think it would be helpful to have that overview fresh in everybody's mind before I go into the particular sections. What this bill does is that it amends Measure 37, and it divides the individuals who have claims under Measure 37 currently, either approved claims or pending claims, into several different pathways. And there are three basic pathways for claimants that have claims that have been approved or that are pending. And those three basic pathways are an express pathway that authorizes the development of 1 to 3 home sites on the property, a conditional pathway that authorizes between 4 and 10 home sites on the property, and then a third pathway for claimants that have vested rights to carry out claims that have already been approved. And so corresponding to those three pathways, in the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1019, I'd actually like to start you with Section 5 of the bill, which appears on page 11. Section 5 is the roadmap for claims that have already been approved or that are pending, that directs those claims into different parts of the bill to give those three different types of relief. So in Section 5, you'll see the different subsections there, 1, 2, and 3. Section 6 of the bill is the express pathway. Section 7 of the bill is the conditional, or the 4 to 10 pathway. And then under subsection 2 of Section 5, Section 9 deals with claims in urban areas. And then under subsection 3 of Section 5, that's the language dealing with claimants who have vested rights to carry out the use that's been approved in a claim. So again, Section 5 is the general roadmap for directing where relief occurs. There is another part of this bill which deals with prospective claims going forward. Those are claims for new land use regulations that are enacted after the effective date of this bill. And those appear beginning in sections 12, I believe through 14. So that's the part of the bill that deals with new land use regulations. That also picks up Section 4 of the bill, which is the amendments to Measure 37 itself. So we're taking Measure 37, amending it to say how it applies to prospective claims, and then there are other sections of the bill that deal with prospective claims as well. That's the general framework. Now let me go through each of the main substantive sections in more detail to describe to you what's in them. So I'm going to start after Section 5 with Section 6. All right, and again, I'm on page 11 of the bill, Section 6, with the caption there, Rural Claims. So again, Section 6 deals with express claims, the 1 to 3, and then Section 7 deals with the 4 to 10, the conditional claims. The language in subsection 1 of Section 6 limits this to claimants who have either approved claims or pending claims. So again, this is dealing with the universe of claims that have been approved or that are pending. Subsection 2 specifies the number, starts to specify the relief that is given for claimants who want to go through the express process. And the relief, again, is the authorization to develop a particular number of home sites on the property, in this case 1 to 3. So the number that the individual gets is limited by the number that was in the claim that they've already filed with the state. So if somebody has filed a claim for 1, they're not allowed to amend their claim to go up to 3. If somebody has filed a claim for more than three, they are allowed to amend down to get into this category, but you can't amend up. The basic requirements to be approved under the express pathway for 1-3 dwellings appear in subsection 5 of the bill on page 12. And there are five basic requirements. The first requirement is that the claimant, in fact, be the owner of the property. The second is that all owners of the property have consented to the claim. The third is that the claimant had acquired the property before March 1, 1994. I talked about that a little bit a week ago, the reason for that. The fourth requirement is that the property be located entirely outside of an urban growth boundary and a city. And then the fifth, and I'm going to dwell on this one a little bit because it's very important, is that it be shown that the claimant lawfully could have developed that number of home sites on the property when the claimant acquired it. This, again, is one of the core provisions of the waivers allowed under Measure 37 currently, the right to do what you could have done when you acquired the property. That's carried forward here. One thing to point out, though, is that the orders that are being issued under Measure 37 currently by government generally are authorizing the claimant to use the property for a use that was allowed when the claimant acquired the property, but they're not specifying a number of homes. The claimant is then having to still go to a county in most cases and figure out whether back in 1976 or 1986, how many homes could have lawfully been developed on the property. This bill would move that determination into part of the claim process and have the order that's issued determine the specific number of home sites that are authorized on the property. This is in order to give certainty to everybody, basically, in terms of what's authorized. That's the fifth requirement here for the express line, is that you have had the right to develop that number of home sites on the property when you acquired it. Subsection 6 of Section 6 deals with a relatively small number of claimants who filed claims after December 4, 2006. And there's a provision under existing ORS 197-352 that in essence requires that in order for a claim to be approved after that date, that the individual first show that he or she applied for land use approval and be denied. Subsection 6 just picks that up for claimants who fall in that category and carries it forward into this authorization. And then in subsection 7, that basically is the language that details what I just said. The order that's issued at the end of this process specifies a particular number of home sites that are approved on the property. And once that is done, any local or state land use regulation that would normally have the effect of prohibiting those home sites no longer applies. Okay. So that's section 6. Section 7 deals with these so-called conditional claims. These are the authorizations for between 4 and 10 home sites on the property. There are many parallels between Section 6 and Section 7, but there are also some important differences. The first thing to note about Section 7 on page 13 is that this authorization for between 4 and 10 home sites on the property is not available to claimants whose property is high-value farmland or a groundwater-restricted area. And this is the first point we get to where the definitions in Section, I believe, 3 of the bill are important. So for high-value farmland, I talked about this a little bit a week ago, but it's the existing definition of high-value farmland in ORS 215.710 with a couple of modifications. One modification deals with so-called harbor bench lands where there's down in the Brookings area, so that's added to the high-value farmlands. And then also certain lands that are suitable for wine growing are also added to the definition of high-value farmland. So if the property in question is high-value farmland or a groundwater-restricted area, then the authorization for 4 to 12 is not available to the claimant.
4 to 10.
I'm sorry, 4 to 10. Thank you, Lane. The claimant is authorized to seek relief under Section 6, which I just described under the so-called express pathway. Okay. So in terms of the number of home sites that may be allowed, that's dealt with under subsection 2 here, and it's 4 to 10, but again, just as in the express pathway, a claimant is not able to amend their claim up. So if the claimant originally asked for 3 or 4 home sites, they can't now ask for 10. But you can amend to come down into the 4 to 10 range. The other significant thing here and the significant difference between this section and Section 6 on the express is that the number of home sites is limited by the loss of fair market value that the claimant has suffered. And the way that works is that I think the easiest way to think about this is the intent here is to give compensation to the claimant in the form of a home site. So you don't get more home sites than you've suffered a loss of in terms of reduction in value because of the land use regulation. So that's also a limitation on the 4 to 10. If you can show that you lost value that's equivalent to 5 home sites, you would be limited to an authorization for 5 home sites and no more. And I'm going to talk about the valuation piece a little bit more in just a sec. In subsection 5, there's a requirement that's a requirement actually in the express pathway as well, that the claimant must have filed a claim with both the state and local government. Almost everybody has done that, but and that has been required by rule for some time now. Okay. Like in the express pathway, the requirements are set forth here in subsection 5, and there are 6 requirements to qualify for the conditional pathway. Most of those are the same as they are for the express pathway. The significant difference here is, again, in paragraph F, at the top of page 15, where we have this requirement that you demonstrate that the loss in value that was caused by the enactment of the land use regulation, that value has to be greater than the value of the number of home sites that you're seeking to develop on the property. So how is loss of value calculated? Loss of value is calculated based on the language in subsection 6 of this section appearing on page 15, and it's the reduction in fair market value caused by the enactment of the land use regulation that is the basis for the claim. That's measured by comparing the fair market value of the property at 2 points in time. The first point in time is 1 year before the enactment of the land use regulation, and the second point in time is the fair market value 1 year after the enactment of the land use regulation. The intent here is to have the measure of loss focus on the harm caused by that enactment. And that's how we've captured that. There are several other aspects to valuation. That difference between the two fair market values of the property is, first of all, carried forward to present at the statutory rate of interest for judgments that exists, which is currently 9%. So if somebody suffered a loss of value as a result of the passage of SB 100 back in 1973, whatever that difference is would be adjusted by that statutory rate between 1973 and present. It would also be adjusted by the present value of any property tax savings that the owner of the property has received, either through farm deferral or through forest deferral, and offset by any severance tax that the individual has paid in the case of the forest tax program, or the recapture provisions of the farm deferral. The intent here is to pick up those in the calculation of loss of value. And those will go both ways. Other aspects of the appraisal, it has to be prepared by a person, a licensed appraiser. It has to conform, the appraisals have to conform to something called USPAP, which is the industry standard in terms of appraisals. The appraisal also has to expressly say, and this is actually required under the industry standards, that the appraisal determine what the highest and best use of the property is. And the language here would require that there be a loss of value only if the highest and best use of the property was for residential use at the time of the enactment of the land use regulation. All right, then in subsection 7 of this section, again, this all ends in a final order that determines a specific number of home sites that are authorized for the property. Those are the two main substantive sections dealing with claims outside of urban growth boundaries. Section 8 then deals with the process for those claims. I'm going to go through that more quickly. The process is essentially that the review of these claims will be done by the Department of Land Conservation and Development within specified time periods. The basic process is that the state will give notice to all claimants that they're entitled to these types of relief under this legislation, and that the claimants need to make a choice as to what type of relief they want to seek within a specified period of time. Once they make that choice, the department then works through the claims and comes to a final resolution for all the approved and pending claims in terms of what specifically is authorized for those properties. That process, although it's operated by the Department of Land Conservation and Development, does also involve notice to and comment from counties that obviously have a very direct interest in this as well, so that they have input to the state on this question of what specifically was allowed on the property at the time that it was acquired. Okay. In Section 9, we get to claims for properties within urban growth boundaries. The concepts are similar here to what I've just described for rural areas. There are a few differences, though. There is a, rather than a range here, there is it's an authorization to develop a number of single-family dwellings on the property, up to a maximum of 10. Again, there's the requirement in here that the property owner be able to show that they lawfully could have developed that number of single-family homes on the property when they acquired it. So same basic structure there. Again, the claimant has to show that they own the property. All owners have to consent. This authorization is also, it's limited, obviously, to single-family residential development, and it's limited to property that is zoned for the purpose of residential use. So this does not authorize other types of development on land within urban growth boundaries. There is also here, just like there was on the other pathways, a requirement that there be a showing of loss of value. It's a little bit different here. It's designed to be a little bit simpler, frankly, to administer. It requires a showing that the enactment of the land use regulation that's the basis for the claim reduced the fair market value of the property. And the way that that is done is by comparing the fair market value of the property at the time it was acquired with the current fair market value of the property. And obviously the fair market value at the time it was acquired is going to need to be adjusted for inflation, and that's done here also. The basic thinking is if somebody can show that their property is worth less now than when they acquired it, you know, that's a showing of harm that then allows them to get the development authorization here. Okay. There is a cap here, and I should have mentioned this earlier with regard to the rural claims here, of 20. These are caps that apply not to the property. They apply to the claimant. It's a limit overall on the number of dwellings that a particular claimant may build under this act in the state. So even though there's a cap for 10, if a person has several properties within a city that are eligible for relief under this, they would be limited to an overall number of 20. Section 10 is the process for urban claims. It's similar to the process that I described for the state. But in this case, as I mentioned a week ago, the entity carrying out the process is not going to be the state. It would be the city or county that has land use jurisdiction over the property in question. And again, it would be consist of a notice to the property owner that they have this right under this act, and also includes a process for obtaining additional information if it's required to act on the claim. The main additional information that obviously is going to be needed here is the fair market value numbers to determine if there's been a loss of fair market value. Section 11 is the next section, and it deals with several things that apply both to the rural claims that I've talked about already and also the urban claims. And they fall into two main categories, development standards and then transferability. When I was describing the authorizations earlier, I noted that what the authorizations mean is that any state or local land use regulations that would have the effect of prohibiting those home sites no longer apply. But development standards, things like a height limit or a setback or a law that says where on the property the dwelling has to go, those still would apply to the establishment of that dwelling. And the owner of the property would still go through the normal process of getting a land division from the city or county and going through a building permit, land use process to address the specifics of where that development occurs and how it occurs. Those development standards would still apply unless they have the effect of prohibiting the use. So if you have a setback that is a practical matter, means you can't put that home on the property, then that would not apply anymore. But if you have if you're in a situation where you have a setback and you can meet it, well, then it would apply. Okay, in subsection 3 here, There are provisions dealing with clustering, and let me walk you through those. If the property in question is zoned for exclusive farm use or designated for forest use, then there's a limitation on the size of any new parcel or lot that's created for this development. And the size is 2 acres if the lot or parcel is located on high-value farmland or on land within a groundwater-restricted area. And again, I don't think I mentioned it. I didn't repeat earlier what a groundwater-restricted area is, but it's an area that's designated as a critical groundwater area or as a groundwater-limited area by the Oregon Water Resources Department or Commission. So limitation on lot and parcel sizes for those areas. And then there's a limit of 5 acres if it's located on exclusive farm use land that is not designated as high-value farmland. There's a requirement in paragraph B that the lots and parcels be clustered to maximize the suitability of the remnant lot for farm or forest use. The concept here is that the development authorization that is granted under this act will, in most situations, leave development on one part of the property and then a remnant part of the property where farm or forest use can still continue. On some of the smaller properties, that may not be true. But if it's possible to cluster, this requires clustering so that you maximize the amount of land that remains for farm or forest use. Subsection 4 deals with situations where we have claimants who have multiple claims for properties that are not contiguous. In some situations, we have 2, 3, 4, 5, even as many as 10 or 20 claims scattered that are not contiguous. This section allows but does not require claimants to cluster development that's authorized under this act on one property. So if somebody in that situation wants to create this could be up to 20 given the overall cap, create a development of 20 home sites on a particular property, this would allow that. They basically transfer their development rights from their other properties to one property. The other portions of Section 11, yes, thank you, Lane. I do want to get that one. Subsection 6 deals with transferability, and I want to make sure I talk about that because I know it's of interest. This is the part of the legislation that specifies that the development authorizations that are provided are transferable. So the way that it does that is that it says that the authorizations that are granted under Section 6 to 10 run with the property and can be transferred or encumbered without affecting the authorization. There's no time limit here, as there have been under some other earlier legislative efforts on this. Except once the property is conveyed, there is a requirement that the development authorization then be exercised within a 10-year period. So let me talk that through to make sure that it's clear. If an individual has an entitlement under this act to develop a particular number of home sites, nothing in this act requires the individual to act on that within any particular time period. But once that individual sells the property or conveys the property in some way to somebody else, then that next person has a 10-year period within which they have to carry the development out. Also, this provides that any dwelling or other residential use that's authorized is a permitted use. and may be established or continued. And this is important because there's been some question under Measure 37 now in terms of development that's carried out. What status does it have legally? Even with the transferability issue aside, whether it's a non-conforming use or something else. And so this is intended to make it very clear that these uses are permitted uses and that those limitations on non-conforming uses don't apply. Subsection 7 of this addresses another issue that's been a question under major existing law, and that is can people file multiple claims? And so this clarifies that there is one claim per property, and once you have a claim filed on property, that's it. You don't get a second claim on the property, except for a new land use regulation. And that's the prospective part of Measure 37 that I'll talk about in a minute. Subsection 8 is an authorization, willing seller, willing buyer authorization for people to acquire the development rights that are authorized by this act. If you have a willing seller, willing buyer. And then subsection 9 is also very important in terms of the transferability issue. This provides that if a claimant passes away during the period of time that a claim is being reviewed and processed, that the heirs of that claimant step into the claimant's shoes and have the same rights that the claimant does. So we don't have the situation of claimants passing away and the rights going away. This bill would make it clear that those rights continue during the time that it's necessary for it to complete this process. Okay, that is the main part of the bill dealing with the approved and pending claims on land outside of urban growth boundaries and in urban areas. The next sections of the bill, 12 through 14, deal with the prospective part of Measure 37. And let me walk you through those. And here I need to take you back first to Section 3, which is
Section 2.
Section 4, which is the amended Measure 37, which starts on page 6 of your Dash 5 amendments. I'm not going to do this in detail, but in essence, the Measure 37 going forward would be limited to land use regulations that restrict the residential use of real property or land use regulations that restrict a farm or a forest practice. I'm reading from page 6 of the bill, looking at lines 27 and 28. The unfairly reduces language there ties to a definition in the definition section, and this is where the threshold that I talked about a week ago exists. The bill contains a provision that in the definitions that defines an unfair reduction in the value of the property as being 20%. So going forward, land use regulations that restrict a residential use of real property or a farm or a forest practice and have the effect of reducing the value of that property by more than 20% would then trigger a Measure 37 claim going forward. Subsection 2 provides that relief would be based on the reduction in the fair market value of the property resulting from the land use regulation. And there the concept is that similar to the sections that I've just described, any authorization for use of the property would be based on the harm that's shown, so that the value of the new use that's allowed would be, again, based on the loss of value that resulted from the enactment of the land use regulation. The then we've got the exemptions, which are pretty much the same. So that essentially describes what Measure 37 would be going forward. It, again, would be limited to residential land use regulations restricting residential use or farm or forest practices. Get to Section 12.
That's page 25.
So Section 12 then clarifies the requirements for a claim going forward and again requires that, as I've just described, that the relief be based on the amount of loss. Again, using the same valuation method that I just talked about when I was describing the conditional pathway for rural claims. So this fair market value before the land use regulation was enacted and fair market value 1 year after. Okay. Sections 13 and 14 I'm not going to describe right now. If there are questions on them, I'm happy to answer them. They deal with the processes for processing new Measure 37 claims going forward. I'll tell you that the language in these Dash 5 amendments is based on language that was used in the development of legislation 2 years ago when the Legislative Assembly was looking at trying to fix some of the questions about procedure under Measure 37. Section 15 deals with intergovernmental coordination and requires local government to give notice of development that's occurring under Measure 37 to county assessors, entities that supply water, and also to a number of state agencies. This is for purposes of making sure that the development that occurs under a Measure 37, under this act, be consistent with the orders that the state has granted on this, and also to ensure that service providers, in particular water service providers, are put on notice about development that may be occurring so they have an opportunity to participate in any local process on that development. Section 16 deals with judicial review and is pretty simple. It provides that judicial review of any order that's issued by the state under this legislation is reviewed by circuit court in the manner for an order in other than a contested case. This is the part of the State Administrative Procedures Act that deals with the less formal non-administrative hearing decisions the state makes. It's an existing process for judicial review that we just plug into. Similarly, for local government, for local government, this plugs into the writ of review procedures, established procedure, the normal procedure for review of city or county decisions that's already established. There is a provision in subsection 3 here that I want to point out that limits judicial review to evidence that was available before the public entity at the time it made its decision. That may sound common sense, but that's actually not the case currently under existing law. And so this would take the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act and the writ of review sections of Oregon law and make that one change to make sure that that's understood. That's how the decisions get reviewed under this particular act. This is, and in land use circles, this is not a surprising concept. It's essentially the raise it or waive it type rule that applies in local land use proceedings. Section 17 and 18 authorize the creation of an ombudsman in the Department of Land Conservation and Development for two purposes. One purpose is to assist claimants or prospective claimants in putting together claims, essentially to work with people to make sure that they understand what's required and the claim that comes in has what's required to get approved. And then there is also an authorization here for the ombudsman to mediate if the state and the claimant agree to that. Okay. Section 19, and then the next parts of the bill are miscellaneous provisions. Section 19 deals with situations where a claimant has had their property recently brought into the urban growth boundary or recently annexed, and this makes it clear that their claim, if they're in that situation, they can't request, for instance, annexation into a city and then be annexed into the city and then make claims based on city land use regulations that they knew were there. It basically, if they've agreed to be annexed into the property, the concept is they've agreed to be, to live with the land use regulations in that city. Section 20 is here. It deals with the appraisals. This is a clarification of law to, yes, thank you, Lane. It's on page 33, a clarification that appraisers are, in fact, authorized to do the type of appraisals we've asked them to do that I talked about earlier. Section 21 deals with some of the details of how we determine when somebody acquired the property. The main thing I'll point out here is we have situations, quite a few claims, where there are multiple owners. And so the question arises, if we've got multiple owners, how does that work if they acquired it at the property at different times? This clarifies that you go with the earliest acquisition date if you've got multiple owners. Sections 22 and 23 authorize the, and I'm sorry, earlier in here, and I think I missed it, there was an authorization to the Department of Land Conservation and Development to charge a fee for review of claims under the conditional path. This is the 4 to 10 pathway where they're going to be reviewing appraisals. And so this is an appropriation and an expenditure limitation for any funds that are collected under that. Section 24 is conforming amendments. In the last legislative assembly, the legislature enacted some changes to the recording statutes to make sure that property owners are on notice about Measure 37 claims. This is conforming amendments to that. And that is it. Sections 25 and 26. 25 is the normal section dealing with the unit captions. 26 is the emergency clause. And that's my summary walkthrough of the bill.
The definitions owner.
Yeah, Lane Shetterly is noting that there are probably a few definitions that I should dwell on. So with the committee's indulgence, I'll take just a minute more,
please.
So the definitions appear in section 2, starting on page 1. I'm not going to go through each one of these, but I'm just going to try to hit the highlights. Okay. Some of these I've talked about already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Subsection 12, land use regulation, I want to emphasize this one a little bit. I've talked about it a couple of points. The focus here is on residential use of the property and land use regulations that restrict farm or forest practices. The definition of land use regulation that appears here mirrors what I talked about there. It's restricting the statutes, rules, and local laws that trigger a Measure 37 claim to essentially restrictions on residential use of property and state laws that regulate farm or forest practices. The definition of owner in subsection 14, this has been an area of significant litigation under Measure 37, and subsection 14 defines owner as including the present owner of fee title and the purchaser under a land sale contract, and if the property's been put in what are commonly known as living trusts, the trustee or trustor, either one, of the living trust. That is consistent with what the state has been doing in terms of review of claims under Measure 37. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitman, and thank you, committee, for holding your questions while we got a walk through the entire set of amendments. But now's the time to ask what's on your mind.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think for order, maybe what we can do, since there's 10 of us, is maybe start at the top, the beginning of the document, and just go through and ask if there's questions about specific sections, and then maybe open it up for other general questions. That way we stay kind of the framework that everyone here has to work with, and then if there's questions that's bigger or broader than just the text, then maybe open that. That way we won't be going jumping around from section to section.
I think it's a good suggestion, co-chair, but what I would just to modify it slightly, I'd say rather than the top of the document, I think it's probably logical to go in the order in which Mr. Whitman presented,
right,
which is starting with section 5, which looks at retrospective claims, and beginning with those that are outside of urban growth boundaries. So I would invite questions that are on Section 5, which is the express lane.
Mr. Chairman, could we go through the definitions first? I mean, could we just go through the bill?
Well, I guess the question is whether you'd rather go start at the very top, which is our definitions, rather than go start where the substance is. But if you prefer to...
Well, the definitions reflect the entire, go through the entire thing. It'd be easier if we started with Section 1 and went through. I understand why Mr. Witness started Section 4, but I think for...
That's fine, Senator. Let's start at the top of the document then. Okay. Any questions about the definitions, Senator George?
Thank you. Lane, you're probably the best one to answer this. In 1993, under House Bill 3661, when the definition of high value farmland was put in place, that covered the vast majority of the land in Willamette Valley counties. Then in this new definition of high-value farmland, you've now thrown in...
Well, can we make reference? Because there's a lot of people following.
Sorry.
What we say, what page,
sorry,
what
page,
line number.
Page 2, line 20, high-definition, high-value farmland. You put in the definition that was put in, the controversial definition that was put in House Bill 3661, and then you add a whole series of additional properties that last... from line 21 through page 3. When you run that through GIS, what does in the Willamette Valley counties, is there any soils that weren't included in that? I mean, is basically all Willamette Valley counties excluded from going into the other option other than the three house option? What's the result of that when you run it through GIS?
Well, Chair McPherson, Senator George, there are two main results. The first result deals with the paragraph B, land west of Highway 101, starting on line 24. That's the Harbor Bench land down near the city of Brookings.
I'm actually specifically talking about the Willamette Valley.
Okay.
When the definition was created in 1993, it was a very controversial set of things, because what it did is when we're dealing with a lot of record in 1993, that was put into place, and what was controversial about it, and one of the biggest hang-ups on House Bill 3661 was the fact that definition would, in essence, block people from getting a lot of records in almost any county that was considered a Willamette Valley county. Now, since then, in 1999, in Senate Bill 99, we put in money for the Department of Ag and Land Conservation Development Commission to have a GIS system that would allow you to plug in these soils and give a percentage of the land, which is the maps that we saw at the beginning of these hearings back in January. And somebody had to have run this definition that's identified here in the dash fives through that GIS system, because I can't imagine there's any soils left in Willamette Valley that would not qualify as high-value farmland in the Willamette Valley counties. Well, I guess what I'm asking, what's the impact in the Willamette Valley counties of this definition?
Okay. Chair McPherson, Senator George, I have not seen maps with these areas plugged into them. I've seen basically what's plugged into them are these viticultural areas that are designated under federal law, and there are seven or eight of them that are designated in the state of Oregon. But it is only the portion of those viticultural areas that meet requirements in terms of elevation, their orientation, and their slope. So it's not all of those areas. It's only certain portions of those areas. That's why I haven't seen the maps. I'm not sure it's possible to produce with the data that we've got GIS maps of that, at least easily. The intent, though, is to pick out only the specific portions of those areas and add only those specific portions of those areas to areas that are designated as high-value farmland that are, in fact, best suited for the growing of wine grapes. So that's what this does.
And Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I can just add to that, this is Lane Shetterly, for the record, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's important, too, I think, to understand that this definition doesn't result in exclusion of development. It draws the claimant and this property into the first track, and so it excludes them from the up to 10, but it does correct. Allow development up to the three home sites.
But, I mean, in essence, that's what it does if somebody has a claim. So I guess what we need to do is, it seems like to me, before we pass public policy, and since I've seen the maps on high-value farmland and probably most of these maps, I would think that you'd want to go back and take a look at that definition and take a look at what it does to claimants in the Willamette Valley counties before we go forward with something like this, because that right there is a dramatic impact on people within the Willamette Valley who has claims. I mean, that's a huge definition, and those maps should be available to us tonight. I mean, because that's easy. We funded a GIS system back in 99, so it should be easy enough to plug into, if it's possible.
Well, we're going over bill language now, Senator, and I would urge you after this meeting just to search out that information yourself. I mean, we've had some information provided and to us in developing the framework, but this is the time where we get down to the details, and this is the time to dig in.
Okay, I think we need maps.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to confirm what Senator George is asking about the higher value of farmland, because I was a member of that work group, and we only talked about that as higher value farmland. I asked and asked repeatedly for a description of higher value farmland, and everyone there can attest to that. And on March 28th, I have the notes that the Class 3 soils was the first time that was ever mentioned. It was only mentioned at 1 and 2, and I never got the definition until April 4th, which was our final meeting. So the definition, and it excludes it almost everybody in Hood River Valley.
Yeah.
That's a huge issue, and I made an issue of that. So
this is one of the significant issues about the bill, and that's what and committee, that's why we're having this discussion.
That's why.
Why don't we ask our individuals here regarding this Class 3. I'm looking on page 2. It looks like we're looking at line 24. Mr. Shudley, why don't you go through, because my understanding that was dealing with a specific area of the state. I think this is the area that maybe in the southwest corner of the state where the lily fields are or whatever.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. The Class 3 reference, Class 3 and Class 4, there is in that definition that Mr. Whitman has already referred to as being limited to the harbor bench, which is a very small geographic area in the far south part of the coast.
So in that definition, when you look at line 24, it does say land west of U.S. Highway 101 and then goes into these specifics. So that would not include such as Hood River County, which is not west of 101. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Mr. Chair, actually, I'd like to answer his question.
Actually, Representative Clem had a question. Let's go to him first.
I mean, I could answer Senator Brzezinski's question, though.
Oh, I think my question's been answered.
But he's mistaken.
I think I can wait because it's going to come up again in section 6. I'll just wait till section 6.
Okay, Senator Beyer.
Well, to get back to this, I mean, Senator George has not had his question answered yet. He's specifically asking about the Willamette Valley, and his question, let me see if I can break it out. You've got, and correct me if I'm wrong, High Valley farmland means, and let's specifically focus on the Willamette Valley. It means 9 sub A, which is on line 21, page 2. It also includes 9 sub C, which is on line 2 on page 3, beginning there. It also then includes 9 sub D, 9 sub E, and some of the A through G in sub E, and then you get to, that would be the end of the, so the question is, if you add up all of those different things that define high value farmland in the Willamette Valley, how much is it? What is left that is not high value farmland? Does that get to your question?
Yeah, exactly. Because there's a specific statutory definition of high-value farmland, which was negotiated in House Bill 3661, that has never sat well with anybody as far as a definition, that was intended to stop any kinds of lot of record inside the Willamette Valley. You guys have incorporated that into a completely unrelated statute, which is Measure 37, and you grab that definition out of statute, which covers the vast majority of the Willamette Valley, which is why he was wrong, and then most of Hood River County and a great deal of the rest of the state. So, I mean, that what Senator Beyer just laid out is a vast majority of the Willamette Valley plus more.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think what I was answering with regard to the Class 3 and 4 soils on lines 24 and 25 of page 2 of the bill is that specific reference to Class 3 and Class 4 defines the harbor bench. The rest of the valley would be picked up, you're correct, by the existing definition of high-value farmland and these other viticultural areas and groundwater-limited areas. Again, with reference to the lot of record, the point being that this does not prohibit development on these soils or in these viticultural areas. What it does, and I guess I'm speaking for committee members having been in the discussions, I think what it does is it recognizes the value of these soils and elevations and slopes in particular to the agricultural economy in such a way that it minimizes the development that will occur on those lands. That's not accidental.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
I guess the point, Lane, is this. Under House Bill 3661, which was a lot of record bill, okay, the people, it was supposed to be able to restore some of the rights. It was an attempt to try to create some sense of fairness. So what you guys did is took a lot of record, which is already trying to instill that fairness, and some people got their lots underneath a lot of record. And so what we're doing is basically, this is House Bill 3661 from 1994, which probably initiated many of the problems that we had that created ballot measure 37, especially with the rules that the agency adopted after that implementation. It just seems like to me it's a terrible place to start. I mean, it just seems like it's faulty from the get-go to use these definitions. So just comment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Klim.
I mean, with all due respect, I was not on the work group either. I have some real questions, and I know that you're just seeing this for the first time, Senator, but we're making speeches and not asking questions, and I respect your right to do that at some point, but I really would prefer if I could get to some questions, you know, with all due respect. I heard their answer. We can work with Ag to get maps. I just would like to go through the document if possible.
Good. We're in the definition section 2 of the bill. Any further questions on that, Senator Beyer?
Thank you. Page 2, lines 6 through 8, you use the language delegated by federal authority delegated by federal government. What parameters are going to be put on that, or how broad does that, or narrow, I guess I should ask, is that going to be defined? Or?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, I could probably answer this most effectively by giving you an example of what it would include, and that would be the state's regulation of water quality under the Federal Clean Water Act. So under the Federal Clean Water Act, the Congress has given states the authority to carry out that federal law within particular states if they meet certain requirements. And so this language is intended to ensure that where the state is regulating, to use the Measure 37 terms, as required by federal law, that would include something like the Clean Water Act.
Follow up that, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Senator.
What if the state adopts a rule to regulate clean water under the guise of the Federal Clean Water Act, but it goes far beyond what the federal rule is?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, to answer that question, I have to take you to Section 4 of the bill on page 7, line 18. You'll see that's the federal exemption language in Measure 37. You'll see it's the same. It says, to the extent the land use regulation is required to comply with federal law. So although this changes the definition of federal law, it doesn't change the aspect that you just asked me about, to the extent required to comply with federal law. So that's still there.
Senator George.
As I read the definition of high-value farmland as it's put into place here, it looks like it applies to rural residential zones also. It doesn't differentiate the zone.
Go ahead. Chair McPherson, Senator George, I think that's correct. I think the definition of high-value farmland isn't limited to a particular zoning.
Okay. That's probably something you should address also.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Klim.
I do have a question in this section, actually. Thank you. two questions. One, this section describing the sort of high-value farmland from before, plus these additional ones that we're sort of calling high-value farmland, that applies just to the 4 through 10 process, and the up to 3 houses you can go on these places?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Klein, that's correct.
One more. The irrigation district, we had a conversation Tuesday night, or some testimony Tuesday night, with a map, and it talked about an irrigation district, a federal project. Is that what that means, or what is, you know, it's on page 3, kind of a big C, then a little C.
Line 2.
Line 2, thank you.
Yeah, that was the north. Mr. Chair, Representative Klim, that was the witness, I think, that was testifying from the North Jefferson Irrigation District, I believe that's what it was.
North Unit in Jefferson County.
Yeah.
If I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Klim. Yeah, and there are several aspects to that. First of all, if the land is within the boundary of an irrigation district, so that's responsive to the question you had about North Unit.
Oh, sure.
But it would also include land that is within the place of use that's authorized under a water right for irrigation. So it's either of those. So even if land is outside of an irrigation district, this would also pick up land that has an approved water right for irrigation use.
Any further questions on the definitions? Senator Schrader.
Mr. Chair, on the sub 12 on page 4, with land use regulation means, any discussion of commercial industrial in that at all?
Chair McPherson, Senator Schrader, no. Again, this with between the definition of land use regulation, which limits the laws that can be land use regulations to things that restrict a residential use of real property, and this
that is on line 8.
Yeah, thank you, Lane. The definition, again, is intended to limit the laws that trigger a Measure 37 claim to restrictions only on residential use and farm or forest practices.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, for instance, you'll see that reflected in other provisions of the draft on page 6, section 4. It, again, reiterates that the basis for a claim would be a land use regulation that restricts the residential use of private real property and farm or forest practice. So that excludes, by that limitation, claims for industrial, commercial, and other non-residential uses.
Any further questions on the definition in Section 2? Then moving forward, we have the policy statement in Section 3 and the revisions in the text of the existing ballot Measure 37.
Chair.
Senator George.
I just want to put on the record that Section 4 of this appears to repeal almost all of ballot Measure 37. That's what Section 4 does.
Well, that looks to me like it clarifies and limits in certain areas. Doesn't repeal, it just modifies.
It repeals all the language. I just want to put that on the record so folks understood what the context was.
Right. And if they can look at it and see exactly what is still there versus what's being added and what's being retracted.
Mr. Chair, I did have one other question.
Senator Breyer.
I forgot pages. Page 5, lines 11 through 18, it's the protection of public health and safety definitions. With this definition as it's written, is there anything that any regulation does that wouldn't fall within this definition? And if there is, could you give me an example of something?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, this language in terms of the definition of protection of public health and safety is obviously for the purpose of one of the exemptions that's provided under Measure 37. It is consistent with the legal position that the state has taken in review of Measure 37 claims for the last 2 years. So it reflects essentially what we've been saying in the review of thousands of claims. We have, denied a claim on the basis of something falling within this exemption very rarely. So it's a practical matter in terms of how this has been applied.
I can take a stab, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. For instance, the $80,000 income test, the 80-acre minimum test, the 160-acre minimum test, the types of regulations that support really what we're seeing in the Measure 37 regulations would not be exempt under that definition of protection of public health and safety. Okay. So someone is seeking relief from Goal 3 that was enacted after they acquired their rural agricultural property. Goal 3 is not encompassed within that definition of a public health and safety regulation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you. Let's look at prospectively then. I think you left in Forest Practices Act and Agricultural Acts. Is there anything in those areas that would not fall into that definition of protection of public health?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, I can think of one thing immediately off the top of my head, which is the acreage limit on clear cuts. I don't think would fall under this, under the Forest Practices Act.
Any further questions on Sections 3 and 4? Senator George.
If you could, I just raise a question. So could you envision... So if we had a farm practices regulation come forward that under the guise of dealing with pollutions, we had setbacks on farmland so you couldn't farm within so many yards of a river under what you just stand, it seemed like to me that would you could regulate and not be susceptible to a claim if you could justify in some way that was related to pollution.
Right. Chair McPherson, Senator George, let me give you an example that I think will help answer your question. This is an area of some significant uncertainty under Measure 37 as it exists now, existing law, what the scope of this exemption is. And but a good illustration of what the uncertainty is you have, for instance, some regulation of forest practices that is directed at preventing or reducing water pollution. There are some forest practice regulations that are for that purpose. And the question has been whether those are exempt or not under Measure 37. We don't know the answer to that still. But some of those regulations are adopted or could be adopted to protect against increases in stream temperature, for instance. Other regulations could be to protect a municipal water source. And those two examples illustrate sort of what's intended here. A regulation that is for the purpose of dealing with water temperature probably isn't, and I say probably because we don't know the answer under Measure 37 right now, but probably isn't related to public health and safety. But if it's something related to actually protecting water quality to protect public health and safety, like a drinking water source, then it probably does fall under. We don't know right where that line is. This is not intended to alter that line, wherever it exists now under Measure 37.
Go ahead.
This changes the language pretty significantly. It seems like it broadened it. So let me give you a specific example. Around 1997, Multnomah County came forward with, Farm Practices Act through its Land Use Goal 5 review, during its review process, which had setbacks on agricultural land within the county. That was a beat back politically, but would you, if they did that, if they did setbacks on farmland, it seems like to me that this definition here with pollution would basically say that the farmer would not have a claim because of this. What would be your answer on that? It seems like this broadens that so that the farmer wouldn't have a claim.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, again, the word, pollution is in this exemption now under Measure 37.
What does this do? I guess I'm asking, what does this do?
It's not intended to change where we're at under Measure 37 now. I don't know exactly what this would do.
Well, I'm going to clarify.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, yeah, I think in answer to your question, and this is true under Measure 37 as it stands today, whether or not a regulation, let's say dealing with setback, would fall within this definition of public health and safety, really would probably depend on the record that establishes the basis for the regulation. If it was for a greenway, just to provide a trail system and access along that, it probably would not fall under the definition of public health and safety. If the record were to establish that it was to prevent the runoff of pollutants into stream water, then that might. So these become difficult to anticipate every permutation in which these may occur. But I think that, I hope that at least helps illustrate at least a couple sideboards. If it's a greenway for recreation, public access, trail system, things like that, that kind of a setback to maintain that would not be exempt, I don't believe, under this definition. If the record establishes that it is indeed for pollution control or something like that, then it's going to be the record that really establishes what the purpose of that regulation is, not necessarily whether it is a setback per se.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
This actually raised a thought for me. This is a good conversation. At one point early in our process, there was some testimony from Oregonians in Action that I think Dave Honeycutt about transportation could potentially be health and safety. And I, at the time, thought I didn't see how that worked. But when you go to this section, if transportation were to, on a rural subdivision, let's say of 10 houses under this, cause what's to be a traffic problem without proper easements and things, then it might be. But if it's just essentially you're annoyed that your neighbor, you know, there's, you know, 30 more cars on the road, then it wouldn't. Because at the time he said it, transportation could be public health or safety, and I thought I didn't see how that could possibly really be. Is this that type of clarity that the measure really didn't give?
You can probably tell by the amount of time we're waiting to answer that question.
Yeah.
I think in that respect, it probably also does not change where we stand in the measure. Because you're right, it's kind of like the setback. It really depends on why that regulation is there, not what you call it. So a regulation that may restrict access, let's say, to a public right-of-way, I'm sure in cases be identified and justified and explained as avoiding dangerous conflict in traffic movement, and clearly that would probably fall under a health and safety regulation. If it is a regulation that is designed more at maintaining capacity, that may have all sorts of good reasons to do that, to maintain the life of an interchange or the life of a road system. But that probably, if without some more direct connection to health and safety, may not fall under that. So these are really hard definitions to provide that are going to apply in a black and white formula to every regulation that may come up. We can identify at least the considerations, but really it is because of that. Just like the Greenway example, I think an access limitation could have clear health and safety implications, and in other cases it could be clearly just to maintain capacity.
Senator Beyer.
One last follow-up on this. So, Lane, what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as long as a public body, whether it be state, city, or county, in enacting an ordinance that would restrict the use of farm practices on property, as long as they made a clear record when they were doing it that this is to minimize the risk of floods, landslides, or pollution in the streams, then there would be no compensation available for any of those actions.
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, I think as a general matter that's correct, and it's reflective of the existing language of Measure 37. It's not intended to alter that.
Let me ask another part of that, though. If it was demonstrated that one of those agencies, as Senator Beyer has said, has used this as a pretext.
Oh, okay.
Sure. So the reality, you just can't walk in there and say, this is why we're doing it, without being able to demonstrate because the courts, if it went to court, just like the 160 lawsuits that we have now involving Measure 37, they're going to look underneath the reason and the actual premise for establishing that type of regulation.
Chair McPherson, Senator Brzezinski, I think that's correct, and I'm sorry I didn't quite understand the question, but I think it's likely that just the fact that a public entity adopts a finding doesn't mean that a court isn't going to look at that and see whether there was some real basis for that. I think that's right.
We keep dropping back to the definitions that we were actually, I think, on Section 4. And if there are no more questions on it, then we're on to Section 5 and 6, where we're getting to the retrospective claims on rural lands, particularly Section 6 dealing with the express lane for up to 3 home sites. Any questions on that material?
Starting on page 11?
Starting on page 11, yes.
This, if I might, this was where my original question
was. Go ahead,
was.
Representative Clem.
And you referred to having explained it the other night, and I apologize for not catching it, but the 94 date versus sort of, you know, the date that the land use application went into effect.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, Richard, I think, was the one who offered that explanation, but basically it was that date corresponds to the adoption of the $80,000 income test, which really was the last major change in state land use policy, at least in terms of land use regulations. Before that, of course, you had the adoption of Senate Bill 100. You had the enactment of all of the land use goals. And then in 1993, the legislature adopted the minimum acreage test for farmlands. That was followed in 1994 by the enactment by the Land Conservation and Development Commission of the $80,000 income test, of the income test that corresponded. And that's what that data is meant to pick up. It's intended to draw a bright line.
Senator George.
Lane, that brings up an interesting question, because in 1997, the LCDC amended Goal 5, and you had a number of counties adopt all kinds of Goal 5 overlays in post-1997. Are those people just left out of the Measure 37 process, because that restricted people's uses in the rural areas too? And you just said that was the last date of major revisions, and the Goal 5 revision was huge and very controversial.
I guess the answer to that question is pretty clear under the bill, and I think this is why the committee is discussing it. Yes, it would exclude the adoption of regulations after 1994 for the purposes of these retroactive claims.
So the answer is all the Goal 5 folks.
Yeah,
are left out.
I was just thank you. And Richard may know that I'm trying to think if, in terms of the extent and number of claims that we have, I'm thinking of claims that are based on regulations coming after that date, claims filed with the state.
Well, if I could, Chair McPherson, Senator George, there are, I can't give you a specific number or percentage, but remember, we're talking about a set universe of claims that have been approved or pending. Very few are based on particularly the Goal 5, very few, if any. In fact, I can't recall any, but there may be some based on Goal 5 changes in 1997.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Go ahead.
This is an important policy issue because ballot measure 56 was not adopted until end of 1998, which means people were not notified of those Goal 5 changes that came into place. So what you could have is you could have a number of people who bought property between 94 and 97. The Goal 5 rules were changed by LCDC, adopted by comprehensive plans in the counties. Major reforms were done. It's only been really less than a decade that they've owned the land. They were never notified of any kind of zone change because prior to ballot measure 56, they weren't. And so they may not even understand yet that those Goal 5 changes may have affected those are major reforms, may have affected their property. So I just want to make sure I'm clear on this, because those were major reforms that had a lot of overlays.
20% threshold. Mr. Chair, just
it's
on
in
that.
Clem.
Going forward then, for a person like that who isn't aware of it yet, if they felt that they had a 20% threshold loss, would they be able to make a claim then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, based on a new enactment or a new regulation, they would. Mm. That doesn't apply to the retroactive claims, although Senator George, so that it's clear, and I think Richard did talk about this as well, if you look at Section 6, Sub 1, these paths that are provided in the bill are provided to claimants who filed claims under Measure 37 before the effective date of the Act. So for retroactive claims, there would not be any more going back on retroactive claims. It's a defined universe.
But they could still file.
Sure. So all retroactive claims are then over at this point? Because I haven't read through the bill, but you're saying anybody who hasn't filed a Measure 37 claim in the past, that has to be done before this bill goes into effect?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's correct.
Wow.
Senator Beyer.
Well, I was going to ask this question anyway, but now I'm just really confused about it. If you look at the Sub 6 in Section 6, page 13, line 7, line 5, it talks about if you haven't filed a claim yet by December 4th, you've got to apply to the local government. So what you're saying is you've got to apply to the local government and get turned down before you can apply for a Measure 37 waiver, and that all has to be done before this bill passes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, that is correct. And that's intended to pick up those people who have filed claims after December 4, and we've gotten, over 100 claims since December 4 based on those filing criteria.
Why would you make them jump through that extra step of going to the local government rather than just filing a claim?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, that's required under Measure 37 right now.
I know, but you're gutting Measure 37, so why would you make them do it after you've done this? You've set up a new express pathway.
I'll take that as a rhetorical question, Senator Beyer.
Yeah, obviously.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
On page 12, lines 2 through 6, I want to ask a couple questions on this. As I read this, if you have a house, which many of the claimants do, this is really just two houses, two additional houses.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, it's a limit of three, including any dwellings, as you just said, that are on the property now. That's correct.
I couldn't follow up. What I'm guessing that the vast majority of people already, who are making a lot of these people have, what's the impact on the claimants right now? On that,
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I wouldn't say it's a vast majority that would have three homes already on.
No, one home. If they had one home,
one
two more.
Oh, I'm sure it is the majority. I don't know if vast applies, but it is the majority that would have one home.
Could we get that number?
Not based on the full 6,900 and some that are currently in. We don't have the drill down to that level at this point.
Mr. Chair, follow up on that.
Go ahead, Senator.
As I read line 3, this isn't per if you have a house on one parcel and you have an adjoining separate parcel, this, and you have a claim on the other parcel that has no houses on it, this is per tract. Even though it doesn't say tract, this is per tract.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, it's per property as defined in the measure. Property is a defined term, and it is the contiguous ownership. It's the contiguous ownership.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Go ahead.
I have a piece of bare land that I could build whatever number of units on it when I bought it. It was zoned a certain way. I turn around and have an opportunity to buy a house on a parcel that's pre-existing next to my existing parcel, so I buy that some years later. It has a house on it. My existing parcel is attached. I'm only allowed two houses on that claim because it's a tract.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, that's correct.
Okay. We'll follow up on that.
Go ahead, Senator.
Okay. As I read lines 2 through 6, what happens in the situation of large parcels that are currently allowed, that are currently under current land use laws, would be allowed to have two additional parcels? So you have a large enough parcel that you could qualify currently for two more parcels. I mean, two more houses currently under current land use law, which is large tract under House Bill 3661. So I have a large enough parcel that I qualify for two more houses. Under this, would basically my 37 claim go completely away, and I would not only would I have my Measure 37 repealed, but even under this situation, I wouldn't have any more dwellings.
No.
Chair McPherson. Chair McPherson, Senator George. No, your claim wouldn't go away. If I understand your question correctly, and let me just restate it to make sure that I do. An individual owns a property that's large enough to get two or more parcels created on that already under existing law. As long as that individual doesn't create the parcels before they go through this process, they wouldn't count against the number of home sites that are authorized under this act. So an individual could get the authorization to do, if there's no home on the property now, three. If there's a home on the property now, two. And then in addition get a land division under existing law.
Any further questions on Section 6?
Good, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to understand, as I read this and try to do my math when we've done a lot of these kind of things before, this significantly down to a very small number of people, of new additional dwellings. And maybe this is better for those who are on the working group. What was the policy decision then to also include groundwater areas? Since we're already limiting the development through this, if this proposal was adopted, since you're already limiting, what's the purpose of using groundwater? Because that just further restricts where people could actually go into that. Maybe that's in the next section, actually. I'm trying to figure out the tie-in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Just to speak to that, so the general policy choice, Senator, was to limit the scope of the development that can occur on Measure 37 claims, and then give transferability so that people actually can use the right that's being given them, unlike the original Measure 37, which created potentially or theoretically much larger scale development, but in fact without transferability made it much harder for people to actually use it. So it's to make a more usable measure limiting the amount of development to the up to three on high value farmland and groundwater restricted areas to avoid impacting inappropriately very sensitive parts of our state, but to allow an opportunity for more development where there wouldn't be those negative impacts.
I guess I'm reading, maybe I'm confused, Mr. Chairman. As I'm reading this, the groundwater limited area also applies to the additional two homes provision. Am I mistaken in that? Because I could be, as I'm trying to read this. I'm trying to figure out how that flows.
No.
It does not?
No.
So even if you're a groundwater limited area,
you're just
okay.
Restricted
on that. That was the question I was asking, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, those are all the questions on Section 6. Let's move on to Section 7, the 4 to 10 opportunity for proof of loss of value. Any questions on that section? Senator Beyer.
Thank you. My first question is the valuation method, Section 6 of Section 7, page 15. I guess, first of all, how are you going to find, how is the valuation of property 1 year prior to and 1 year after regulation that was enacted 30 years ago going to be determined?
Comparable sales. Got there before and after.
Yeah. Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, this method of valuing the effect of the enactment of a regulation is actually the same method that is used in regular inverse condemnation regulatory takings cases. So it's not although obviously there are some challenges in terms of going back 30 years, it's not necessarily novel in terms of being a method. How is it going to be done? You're going to need to go back and look at comparable sales of just as you normally would in an appraisal 1 year before and 1 year after historically, mm-hmm. as best can be determined based on whatever data is out there. And in some counties, that's going to be easier than others. So,
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. On that section also, you speak of difference of the, or adding back in the savings from property tax minus any severance taxes or recapture of deferred taxes that the owner has paid. I think I know what that means with the application, but let me throw this at you. What about the ownerships that have been under small tract optional tax and for forest land where there has not been severance tax paid, yet the land was taxed at a higher use than forest land instead of severance tax?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, I am not an expert on these particular programs in terms of the tax deferral or small woodlot tax. The basic intent here is that the valuation reflect both any benefit that the property owner has or will receive as a result of these programs, but also offset from that benefit any additional amount that they would pay in terms of a severance tax or a recapture if it's a deferral. So that's and with that, I'd certainly be happy to look into it in more detail and get you a more detailed response to your question, but that's probably the best I can do tonight.
Another question on that subject?
Go ahead.
And if it is just severance tax, does the landowner have to go back and identify which tree, the stump, or which stump that the log was sold from and the property tax was sold off of it, or is it any and all severance tax that the landowner has ever paid?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, I simply don't know the answer to that question. I can certainly try to find the answer for that question for you.
We can always exclude that portion if it's complicated to you. Eliminate the severance tax payback. I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, this is an adjustment for the benefit of the claimant by carving out of the tax abatement. I mean, the tax abatement can be shown by showing historically the difference between real cash value and the reduced value on which they were paying property taxes, and this was sort of an adjustment back in favor of the claimant so that they would get something carved out of that differential based on their having paid some tax.
I understand that, but is it based on all the severance tax that landowner has paid, or is it based on would the landowner have to go back and identify the severance tax based on the parcel that is up for, you know, a claim?
Well, I think it'd be an opportunity for the property owner to demonstrate the severance taxes they paid. I mean, they could forego this adjustment, and it is in there for their benefit.
So you don't, at the end of the year, have to pay the tax.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I have some questions on the section, but I'd like to stick, if I could, with subsection 6 since we're talking about it. Mr. Whitman, you referenced that this is a mechanism that has been used in reverse condemnation and regulatory takings cases.
Right.
I can't, in this particular way of doing it, going back this many years on regulatory takings cases, I don't know if there can be one regulatory takings case that's come forward where they've used this kind of appraisal method. They've always used the appraisal methods that's currently in ballot measure 37. So can you give me an example of where they've used that?
I can. Chair McPherson, Senator George. The thing that's unusual here is the time delay that we have under Measure 37. But if you go to U.S. Department of Justice Yellow Book, which is the manual that's used for appraisals in condemnation and inverse condemnation proceedings that the federal government's involved in. This is the method that the Yellow Book calls for inverse condemnation cases. If you also go to the sort of main treatise on eminent domain, Nichols, and look for the method that's used in inverse condemnation cases where the action that the takings case is brought based on is the enactment of a law, the normal method is to go back and look at the value of the property before the enactment and after the enactment. And that's based on Nichols also. So I know I'm not giving you specific instances, and that's because it's very unusual to have a takings case where the action that resulted in the taking in the regulatory takings context would have occurred 30 years ago. Normally a statute of limitations would have long run on that. But in this situation where we have a new law that gives an entitlement to relief based on something that happened a long time ago, this is a method that is the accepted method that's used by federal government and in the treatises.
Mr. Chairman, follow up on that, actually. Mr. Whitman, actually, as I understand how that's used, it's when the regulation is applied to the land, which is referenced in Ballot Measure 37. So what would happen is that you could have an enactment under the Clean Water Act at some point. The Clean Water Act was adopted in the early 1970s. It affects my rock pit in South Carolina today. I go in, which I think the case was actually Mississippi. They actually rolled it up exactly like Measure 37 does, and they said the application of the law was at today's date, not 1973. So I actually disagree with you, because the application is when the regulation was applied to the land, not when the regulation was adopted. And so that's completely inconsistent with that federal.
Senator, really the purpose of this is to kind of draw information from them, and they're
and if you do disagree, the thing to do is, if when we get to working the bill, if this is what we're working, you can bring your own, measure evaluation forward. But for us to be sitting here and having you argue and challenge the witnesses, they give an answer as to you thinking it should be something different.
No, I'm asking about current law. I mean, here's the problem I have, Mr. Chair, is that when I ask a witness a question and I think he answers it incorrectly, and I know the law, and I ask him the question to clarify it, I'm arguing what I view as current law. And under current federal regulations, as I understand them, and it's just my understanding, and I could be wrong, I'm not saying it, I just disagree with Mr. Whitman. I'm actually asking to clarify it. And it's an important point that he's made. He's made a statement here. And I actually think that when we look at the federal law that Mr. Whitman has pulled to use this application, it's actually applied incorrectly, because I think it's the application of the law, not the enactment of the law. And so I just actually think this is a really solid discussion. It's a pretty deep discussion on land use law, I'll grant you that, but I think it's a completely legitimate discussion of what the actual right correct answer is. I mean, that's my problem.
I think the question, Senator George, is whether it's a good use of all the committee's time to pursue, to try, you know, I think it's great that you want to drill down deep in this issue. I think I applaud you for doing that. It's just a question of whether we should do that in a group of 10. Senator Schrader had indicated he had a question. We do want to be.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, this whole issue of this whole proposal under the Dash 5s comes down to this appraisal process. And this appraisal process, as I read it, pretty much makes it nearly impossible for somebody to make a Measure 37 claim. And I view this as the heart and soul of this proposal, because in essence what it does is, with this odd definition of appraisal definition, you've basically eliminated the opportunity for the vast majority of people, and I would say vast majority of people, to ever make a claim, and especially going in the future with the 20% issue that you have also included in this proposal. This particular question I'm asking is key to the entire proposal, and that's why I'm asking it. So I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just saying.
Ask questions that fully inform you, and then if you think it's not the right way to go, then bring forward another evaluation proposal.
And the reality is that we don't have the Yellow Book, and that's not what we're going to hang up on at this point. We did have testimony earlier about at least three different models that could be used. This is the one that's been selected, and if you choose to bring something else that's forward,
can do that for. You can have Mr. Whitman at your office on your time with the yellow book, and you can discuss the ins and outs of what the yellow book does or doesn't apply or provide.
Mr. Chairman, the problem we have here is Mr. Whitman testifies.
That's right.
On a fact that I think is actually incorrect. So we have everybody who's watching on TV, everybody's in this room, and this panel, and what I view is actually incorrect law. So I was asking to clarify a very specific point, and it's key. I mean,
and he's clarified it, and I would say if this was a court of law, I would say object, question asked and answered, because he's answered it twice, and we'll move on.
Well, what was his answer?
Yeah.
I mean, just
move on.
Could he answer it?
Senator Schrader would have wanted to ask a question. I think we ought to allow other members of the committee to ask the things that are on their mind as well.
I was just going to tear into Senator George. I'll defer that to the next work session and move on.
I see. Are there any further questions on Section 7, I think it's that we're in the bill now, on the 4 to 10 based on proven reduction in value?
I have just a real quick question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask you to describe highest and best use that was used on page 16, Section C, expressly determine what the highest and best use of the property was at the time the land use regulation. What is the highest and best use description?
Chair McPherson, Representative Smith, I'm not a licensed appraiser, but my understanding of the term highest and best use and what's intended here is that the highest and best use is the use of the property that is legally permissible and would yield the highest value for the property, and that's reasonably likely to occur on the property. I believe that's the general definition of highest and best use that's used in their appraisal methods.
Representative Garrard.
Mr. Whitman, do you recall the question that Senator George just asked you?
Chair McPherson, Representative Garrard, it got a little muddy there at the end. I think so.
Would you answer that same question to me?
Representative Garrard, why don't you rephrase the question? I think that might help. Just because I think it may help come
Well, we're trying to get at the appraisal, and that's why I asked Mr. Whitman if he had an answer.
If I could, Chair McPherson, Representative Gord, I think there was a bit of a misunderstanding there between myself and Senator George, and we were talking by each other in terms of what we were talking about. I was talking about what the normal, if we can use that word here, appraisal method would be to try to measure the effect on value of the enactment of a land use regulation. And Senator George, I believe, was or thought he was asking me about what's the accepted method under Measure 37 as it exists now. And you know, what I'm trying to illustrate here is under this act, the focus and the thing that you are measuring, the act that you're measuring, is the effect of the enactment of the land use regulation. And that is a difference from Measure 37 as it exists now, which talks about the effect of the enactment or enforcement of the land use regulation, which I think is the point that Senator George was trying to make. We don't know what that language means under Measure 37 right now. It says literally the reduction in fair market value resulting from the enactment or enforcement of a land use regulation. And one issue that's being litigated is which one is it? How does it get measured? And we really don't know the answer to that. This bill clarifies that to say that it's the effect of the enactment of the land use regulation on the fair market value of the property. And so if that's the focus, that's the act that results in the reduction in fair market value, what I was trying to say is that would be the normal way of measuring that thing. I hope that helps.
Thank you for your response.
Senator George, you have a question?
Yeah. Under the appraisal method, you have the recapturement of special assessment, as you described it as deferral. and coming from agriculture, I view this assessment. So under the original framework we had in this state, you had the assessment, which was on land zoned for EFU, which was you assess the value at the zoning that was allowed. The deferral was for rural residential or land zoned other than agriculture, and that's what Senate Bill 101 was about. So you could opt into the deferral program even though your land was zoned for something much higher. As I see here, land that is zoned exclusive farm use, so you had no development use whatsoever in the last 30 years or whenever the enactment or enforcement of the regulation was in effect. You were assessed at agricultural rates because that's all you could do with the property, which is an accurate reflection of what the tax rate should have been. This right here applies to all 97% of land that's in exclusive farm and forest zones, and I think it should only apply, and tell me how I'm reading this wrong, why it shouldn't apply only to the small percentage of land that's allowed in rural residential zones. Do you understand my question? It's complex.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, I think I do, and if that is the effect, that's not what is intended. Again, the concept here is to include in the valuation of the property any tax benefit that the property tax benefit that the owner has received, and if the property is zoned exclusive farm use and only exclusive farm uses were allowed on the property, you may be correct that this is overbroad, and we can certainly look at that. I don't think that's the intent here.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, the reason I asked that question, because I want to make sure we get this correct, is that in earlier testimony when you were talking about it, you were discussing the fact that on somebody's county assessment records, it would be easy to maybe land use. You it'd be easy to calculate this because of the fact that you would go back and see what the real market value was versus the assessed value under the farm assessment. The problem with that is that anybody who didn't contest the real market value, which had no impact on them, so they didn't ever go back and challenge that because it had no impact on them. If they took that differential, they could end up having a huge amount marked against their taxes, even though that's not really what their property was, should have been real market value. If we base it off what the county assessors say, we could have all kinds of problems here. And what you have is you have all the farmers who had their land taxed at actual rates of what they could use the land for being uptaxed in this, under this scenario, the way the language is written here. I guess I'm trying to get at what you're in. Somebody has a piece of EFU zone land. The real market value that, as shown on the assessor's records, is significantly high than the real market value because of the fact that they couldn't use the land for anything other than agriculture. It was assessed and taxed at the market value because it was farmland. The assessor had this number up here that meant nothing to anybody because the farmer was still taxed at its real value under the zoning. It seems like to me that the farmer shouldn't have to pay this huge gap simply because the assessor made a mistake in their records. And so it seems like to me that this language should only apply to land that isn't zoned for resource use.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, your question's a good one. It's essentially a policy question that I don't know the answer to. But I agree it would be good to clarify what the intent is.
Thank you.
Here.
If there are no further questions on...
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Clem.
I'm sorry. On that last piece, just because I know we're not going to get the answer right now, but I guess the basic question I would also like to have answered is at one point somebody brought a property tax statement in, and it said, I think real market value, $335,000, and then some other kind of value, $500, and then they only owed $7 for that whole year in taxes because it was based on the 500, not the 350. And so obviously there are, you know, some people feel that is some form of a compensation mechanism in the formula, and I guess I would like to know if that's what we're trying to get at is, you know, what the taxes would have been at 350 if it was in their county inside of or outside of a farm zone would have been $4,500 instead of $7. And if so, I'd like to get an answer to that.
Okay. If that's all in Section 7, then Section 8 is a process section related to the up to 3 and then 4 to 10
home sites. If there are no questions about Section 8, Mr. Chair.
Senator
Beyer.
Just wanted to be real clear. Under this section, I see a 120-day timeline for DLCD to notify landowners. I see 90 days for landowners to reply back to them. I see 180 days for them to get an appraisal and get the information back to DLCD. But I see nowhere in here that says how long it's going to take DLCD to process those claims, except for first come, first serve.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that is addressed in on page 17, line 5. I'll tell you, that is, I'm sorry, line 28, sorry, subsection 5 on page 17. We don't know as we sit here today if these two paths go forward, how many are going to come in under the express lane, how many are going to come in under the conditional path that would involve the appraisal methodology. I don't know how to offer at this point, as we sit here, a statement as to how long it will take to move a claim through the process. The intent here is to move them as promptly as possible, and we have in here consistent with sound review of the claims and available resources, and report to JLAC so that we're accountable back to the legislature based on not a projection as we sit here today of what the world may be a year from now, but based on the actual claims history so that we're developing a sense of what the track record is coming in, and that's about the best we can offer.
Well, let me just ask a clarifying question. If the legislature, in its wisdom, decided that they don't really want you guys processing claims, they're not going to fund them, or anybody to fund them, by having the words available resources in there, does that mean the DLCD could say, hey, we can't process claims until after the legislature meets 2 years from now, if it was...
Chair, Senator Beyer, I think that's probably an unlikely scenario, but yeah, if the legislature were to defund the agency, I don't know how you would process claims. So I think there is obviously a commitment implied here that the legislature will provide resources with which to process these claims at a rate that the legislature wants to see processed, and then consistent with that will be the direction of the statute or the bill to the department to complete its review as promptly as possible and then report back to provide that accountability to the legislature based on the experience as it evolves with the claims coming into the door.
Just another on that issue, and I realize this is jumping ahead, but in Section 10, I see that in a city or county, you've put a 150-day timeline on them to process claims.
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, the reason for the shorter time frame on the city claims simply reflects the lower, significantly lower number of claims that exist within cities. I think I hesitate to give you a statewide total, but it's in the hundreds instead of the thousands that exist on the county/state claims. So that's all that reflects.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
Just a practical question. I think we voted it through the floor of the House, actually, the other day. Or did we just move that out of committee, your budget, for this next biennium? I think it was out of committee. Yeah. And it provided 16 processors.
Representative Chair, Representative Clem, not 16 processors. That's the entire section. So there's administrative staff there. So that's everybody.
Do you feel like the budget that we've so far approved out of the subcommittee, at least on natural resources, is sufficient for these tracks if this were to become law at this point?
Let me answer that. We're still looking at exactly what the impact's going to be. We've asked them to give us this
as to, so we can figure what has already been contemplated, whether or not it needs to be adjusted.
Thank
because
you.
This bill also has some other, let's say, requirements that will need to be done, and so we've asked for that assessment.
Thank you.
And that will be forthcoming. Thank you.
That's right. And they said that in committee, too. I forgot.
If there are no further questions then on Section 8, then we have Section 9 and 10 on urban claims. Any questions on those sections? And hearing none, we have Section 11 on the scope of the rights that are being created by sections 6 through 10 and how they become applicable. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 22, line 25, when you're talking about clumping these potential, who decides what is maximum suitability?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, that would be a decision that would be made by the city or county acting on a permit for the dwellings.
This is a follow-up. Is there any criteria, standard, anything, anywhere that would point to what that means?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, there's the text that's in the section there. Beyond that, to the extent there's any discretion allowed there, which I think there is some, that would be left to the local government.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 11, line 2 through 6, the way this is drafted, tell me if I'm... was this intentional or not, a person could go through the express route onto three lots or two additional if they already have one, could get to Section 11 on the actual application, and if you and as I read this, you could have development standards that were adopted by a local jurisdiction that they would kick those two lots out, those two additional houses out, as that's drafted.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, that certainly is not the intent. Again, the intent, as I expressed when I went through the walkthrough, is that if you have the entitlement to two or three lots created under the earlier sections, that you could create those two lots, and that if any development standard would prohibit those lots or prohibit the dwelling on the lot, that those development standards then wouldn't apply.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I may, that is actually in that same section on lines 5 through 10. I think that gets at it. However, the standards must not be applied in a manner that has the effect of prohibiting the establishment of a dwelling lot or parcel authorized, unless we're talking about nuisance, public health and safety, or federal law regulatory limitations.
If I could, Mr. Chair, follow.
Go ahead.
As I read that, it's singular, and therefore what you would have is that what you would end up with is one.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, that's certainly not the intent.
Okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chair, with that language, I agree with Senator George. I agree with Mr. Whitman. That is not correct. If you look at online section 1, a dwelling authorized under section 10, if you have three dwellings authorized, each of them is a dwelling authorized.
Right. So an example would be, I mean, if you go to the, let's say, more of the extreme of where there could be these exceptions of why you wouldn't be able to place it. First of all, if it's a site that has restrictions on it, you would still be able to do it, with the exception that if those standards were reasonably necessary to avoid an abatement of a nuisance, etc. So if you had the ability to put three on there, and even though you may be putting it on a high-value area, you could put all three on there unless one of those three was being limited for some other reason as stated in lines 8 through 10.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And again, go back to the example of the greenway setback, so that it's not a pollution control, not a health and safety. The dwelling standards might, if applied literally to an allowed dwelling or allowed dwellings, might say you can't locate footprint of a dwelling inside that greenway. But as long as that greenway is not there on the basis of one of these specific purposes, that greenway would have to give way to the right to locate the dwelling. Same thing if it's set back from a road for aesthetic or other reasons that don't implicate nuisance, health and safety, or federal law. It's the same thing that if you would, well, in fact, I'm trying to think. I think there was out of in Prineville, for instance, there was the setback at the on the Rimrock that was not health and safety. That was aesthetic to protect the view shed from below. That would be one where I would see here if the effect of requiring compliance with that particular development standard would have the effect of disallowing an otherwise approved dwelling, then the right to develop that dwelling would prevail over the setback.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Senator.
In Section 11, lines 19 through 22, there's a discussion of the clustering, why would we want to have two-acre lots in EFU zones if we could avoid them? What's the policy decision on that? What are we trying to get? Because under LCDC rules, anything under your own rules, anything under 2.5 acres is considered urbanized. So it kind of seems kind of odd.
Pardon?
Right.
Yeah, two. Yeah, it's two. 2 acres is the urban standard. Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think there's a policy call here. I'll try and reflect, I think, what that was, and that was the sense that if you are talking about placing dwellings in high-value farmland, the better way to, in most instances, the better way to preserve, to maximize the remnant of that high-value farmland is to cluster the dwellings in one area and maintain the open area for agricultural production, as opposed to spacing widely dwellings across the footprint of the agricultural property, the farm property, with then roads and everything else that goes with those dwellings. So, again, I think that was a policy call, but I believe I'm reflecting what that discussion was.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
That's a policy discussion we ought to have by looking at the Census of Agriculture, but we'll get back to that when we do the policy side.
Good.
I'm trying to understand. I bought my land in whatever, 19-whatever, and it was in a 10-acre zone.
It would be important to specify the date.
Well, but not under this question. It isn't.
Okay.
I bought it under a 10-acre zone. I lost my right to build. I'm granted back my rights under some scenario like this, and under this clustering situation, my zone that I'm trying to recover, that I'm trying to get grandfathered in, is a 10-acre zone. Under this proposal, you would be granted the 10-acre zone, but then they would be clustered. I mean, how does that deal with people who had zoning that was in larger lots? Do you understand what I'm saying? So you originally had a 10-acre zone or a 20-acre zone or a 40-acre zone. You applied under Measure 37 to regain that 20-acre, 40-acre, 10-acre agricultural zone. Under this proposal, do you then cluster it, even though your original zoning was 10 acres, 20 acres, or 40 acres, whatever?
Yeah. Chair McPherson, Senator George, this would require clustering again for land that is zoned, property that's zoned for exclusive farm use or designated for forest use. So to answer your question, if it was originally in an EFU...
an AF-10, for instance.
Yeah, an AF-10. Well, actually, the AF-10 zone in Washington County, in any way, is not an EFU zone.
Oh, that's right, it's Ag 4. But just like, let's say, for instance, you have an EFU-20.
All right. Chair McPherson, Senator George, if you had an EFU-20, yes, this would require the clustering on 5 acres if it's not high value or groundwater restricted, or 2 acres if it is.
Okay. Senator Schrader.
Just a point of information. We had information from Farm Bureau and others that they would like to have driven those numbers down even further. Of course, it would depend on the PERC test and whether or not they're able to actually use that land.
Now, there was input not only from the Farm Bureau. We also talked to the Forest Council to find out for the two different types of reserve lands that we have within our land use structure as to how they thought it would be best. So there was some outside input.
I will say, since if I could, Mr. Chairman, in response to that, just so you know, if you look at the Census of Agriculture, the most productive farms we have per acre in the state are farms that are that are 10 acres or less. So just policy-wise, it may not be good for agriculture. I understand there may be interest groups that want something to happen, but for the policy of the state and what's good for the agriculture going in the future, that may not be good public policy. Thank you.
I'm not sure I concur with that.
Any further questions on Section 11? Then we're on
Mr. Chair.
Senator Schrader.
Just to reiterate what has already been said, but on page 23, section 11, line 23, it talks about the lot or parcel lawfully created shall remain a discrete lot unless the lot or parcel lines are vacated. Just to make sure that if that occurred, that there was no second bite at the apple for another Measure 37 claim based on the wording elsewhere in this document.
Chair McPherson, Senator Schrader, that's correct. There, even notwithstanding this language, there would be no second claim.
Okay. Senator George.
It's on page 23, lines 19 through 23, and I understand I just got this tonight, so I'm trying to get through this. There is a 10-year conveyance with a time limit. It seems like that accelerates development. If I could maybe have a discussion of why we would want to accelerate development that otherwise wouldn't happen. If somebody wants to leave in an ag zone but maintain their rights, what would be the policy to force them to develop?
Well, I can speak to the policy point. There's no acceleration at all for the original owner who has the Measure 37 claim, and, of course, the whole opportunity to transfer that is something that's created by this bill. But the policy choice is not to have these old Measure 37 rights arising in the far distant future, that there is a distant endpoint, but it'd be 10 years after the last of the Measure 37 claimants has passed on or sold the property.
But could, Mr. Chairman, if I can, it seems like to me that if a farmer wanted to buy a piece of property that had a Measure 37 claim on it, it would actually prohibit agriculture from purchasing those, because if they want to keep it out of the development for longer than 10 years, they would be buying at a higher price than somebody who wanted to develop before, and that would be bad for the future of agriculture in the state. I just, policy-wise, it makes no sense to me, so appreciate it.
Any further questions on Section 11?
Mr. Chair, if I may just begin reflecting on discussions that I recall on this point. I think the consideration there to Senator George is part of the of what I think is intended here also though is to provide the benefit of that development right for the claimant who's selling the property, and so frankly I think that's not unintentional that price would be reflected, that the development right would be reflected in the price, so that the claimant who himself or herself does not develop the property will capture the value of that development right on sale of the property.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, but then what you do is you put the land in two categories, ones that farmers can buy and ones that farmers can't, and so any agriculturalist that's looking beyond 10 years would be precluded from purchasing this property because it would be artificially high, and so that doesn't make any sense, policy-wise.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is a policy call.
Thanks.
Well, and I have to say, Senator George, is sort of the basic driver in Measure 37, that is that it elevates the value of our farmland above what it would otherwise be worth and makes it harder for farmers to afford it. So the general configuration here is to try to balance the concerns of the property owners who feel they've lost something in value with the desire to have a sustain a viable agricultural.
If you want to repeal Measure 37, I'd be fine with that too, Senator, but I don't think the public out there would appreciate that.
Actually, no, you already did here, Mr. Schrader.
No, I would actually
Mr. Trader. I guess the policy flip side of that is that once this is adopted, you may have an agriculturist that wants to buy a piece of property. And all I'm saying is that puts that agriculturist in a position when he buys one of these pieces of property of forcing development. And I think that once you accept this and you go through this process, I just think that that's a policy decision we'd have further discussion about.
Anything further on that section 11? Not. Then we're on to
prospective, section 12 for prospective claims. And let's group that together with this section. Well, section 13 is on, no, I guess that applies both forward and back. So so section 12 would be the focus first. If no questions, then section 13. And then really these later sections get into much more procedural matters, including section 16 on judicial review, which is probably not going to have people leaping off their seats with questions. Although maybe so, Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair,
you are so mistaken, my friend.
I hope you're not already in section 16. Cause
okay, no, go. I didn't mean to race ahead too quickly.
No, we're on 13.
I got a question on 13. Under current measure 37, there are, and I don't know exactly what it says, but there are legal fees for. Is it legal fees for claimants if they win their case, but not for the local governments or for the government entity? Is that retained in this, or does this go back to what was done in 1037 of last session where that provision is gone?
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, there is under Measure 37 as it exists now a statutory right to attorney fees for claimants who successfully bring a Measure 37 claim for compensation. This bill would replace the authorization for compensation with an authorization for development rights, and it does remove the provision with regard to attorney fees.
And a follow-up on that? I believe that I see this in this is that you have a fee that will be charged up to $1,000 to file a claim.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's what is in the bill. Some counties and cities now have adopted filing fees. It's unclear under ballot measure 37 whether or not they can actually enforce them, and so you've had an odd situation where some people pay and some people don't, and the claims get processed just the same. This clarifies the authority to charge a filing fee. Currently, under state law, the state does not charge a filing fee, does not have authority to charge a filing fee. This bill, if adopted by this committee and the legislature, would establish that authority. Assuming, I guess, apart from the adoption of this, I think Senator Schrader could probably answer better. I do believe that would still require an action by the Ways and Means Committee to create a limitation that would authorize the receipt of that. So that is indeed how this would work if it's adopted and fully implemented.
So just as to continue on that, a person who has already filed a claim, accepted a claim, Measure 37 claim, chooses to go down either of these pathways, they would be required to refile and pay a $1,000 fee or up to whatever.
Chair McPherson, Senator Beyer, no, that's not correct with regard to a claimant who has an approved claim or a pending claim who chooses to go under what we've called the express.
Right.
Pathway.
It's the place where the appraisal is. Where what we've looked at in the policy was, if we have appraisals coming in, the processing that is going to be much greater in time and resources as compared to under the express lane, as compared to the conditional route.
And I might direct you to back to page 17. There's a provision for fee up to $1,000 for the retrospective claims, but it's limited to the Section 7 claimants, the ones who are going through the prove your loss in value. The policy choice was that the express lane for the up to three would be no additional cost or charge to the claimant.
Which page did you? Oh, there it is.
Page 17, line 27.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, actually, you raise a good point. I think if you look on page 27, subsection 3, that is in section 11, which has the caption procedures for actions on new claims, which is why I think the distinction is made between this and claims that have already been filed on retroactive. If it's not clear, that may be worth making clear that that applies to claims filed under section 12, which is the claims on claims on new regulations.
I think when you look, Lane, at the section 12 where it talks in the very first lines 1 and 2, it talks about people within sections 12 and 214. That may do it, but if not, we can clarify it more.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to follow the perspective here through the claims process, and so if I could ask a scenario. Under somebody has a claim that, under the definitions on page 5, unfairly reduced means a reduction of 20% or more in the fair market value. I guess fairly reduces anybody who loses 19% or less. But with that being said, as I read this, a state agency or a local government could adopt a ordinance, a zoning ordinance, or a rule that said some language such as, this is effective as long as it does not reduce the property by more than 20%, and avoid all prospective claims. And then the question is, as I read that, that's a little unclear, but as I read that going forward, if that's true, then could a state agency just continue to adopt those, continue to take 19% of your land over and over and over, and there's no cumulative effect? So there's a two-part question there. Could you avoid it by just simply writing to your ordinance, as long as it doesn't take over 20%, and then you could do that repeatedly?
Chair McPherson, Senator George, there is a 20% threshold. So if the public entity enacts a land use regulation, and remember that's a defined term, and it does not reduce the value by more than 20%, then there would not be rights under this prospectively. That's correct.
So they could write that into their code and say, and that would basically nullify any claims against that particular ordinance or regulation.
Chair McPherson, Senator George, I really would rather not speculate on a particular method that an entity might use. I don't know whether...
We don't have that luxury,
well,
Mr. Whitman.
Senator George, I just don't know without looking at the whole thing whether that would work or not. But again, is set forth here in this act, if it in fact did not reduce the value of the property by 20% or more, then there would be no right.
So could I do that repeatedly with different regulations over and over, as long as one knows, as I read this, as long as no single regulation took away more than 19, as long as it took 19% or less, you could continue to take 19% of a person's property under the way this is drafted currently?
Chair McPherson, Senator George, the way this is drafted, enactment is a defined term here also. So it's 20% per enactment.
Per enactment, yeah.
So if there were multiple enactments, this does not deal with that situation.
Okay. Senator Schrader.
Well, just maybe to give some comfort to Senator George and others, I've spent a little time in the land use process too, and I haven't seen too many cities or counties go to that level of detail and trying to, just get regulations under the radar screen. And the other thing I'd point out is that when we looked at this threshold issue, we grappled with it, tried to figure out what's reasonable compared to other states, and this does seem to be very consistent with what other states who have dealt with these types of property rights issues are doing, and so we're just trying to be consistent.
In fact, it might be helpful to have described the several other states that, if you remember those numbers, I don't remember them off the top of my head, but...
Chair McPherson, there are a number of other states that have enacted laws to provide compensation or other rights to individuals who have had the value of their property reduced by regulation, and... those include some of the earliest examples were Texas and Florida, also include Mississippi, Louisiana. Very recently, Arizona adopted by initiative a measure very similar to what we have prospectively. Florida has no specific threshold. Texas has a threshold of 20%. Louisiana and Mississippi have thresholds of 25% and 40%. and Arizona has no threshold in its newly enacted law.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Senator George.
In those states, though, they have cumulative effects. In Texas and Louisiana, I know for sure they do. In Arizona, they have zero threshold because they adopted Measure 37. And furthermore, if I could, Mr. Chairman, no other state in the union has adopted our land use system. And so, I mean, they all adopt Measure 37. I'm getting that we've adopted a lot of property rights types of measures around the country, but we're not adopted Oregon's land use laws, and therefore it's different on how these ordinances go forward. It's a dramatic impact on landowners and state on the prospective part, especially if there's no cumulative measure in there. And I just want to make sure that's on the record. Thank you.
Anything further under Section 13? And 14 and 15, and then we are getting into the things that are pretty procedural.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure I'm going to have a lot more questions when I get a chance to read it.
And you should.
It's very complex.
Obviously, we all got this just at the same time here at the start of the meeting.
We took a three-page measure that had some ambiguities and made a 30-some-odd-page measure that is...
Gives clarity.
Yeah, gives clarity like mud.
Well, 160 lawsuits doesn't seem like it did.
That's why we have the Land Use Board of Appeals, my friend.
We have the Ombudsman in Section 17.
I could, Mr. Chairman.
Representative George.
Typically, an ombudsman is to be the referee between what was the policy decision to make that's appointed by the LCDC. Yeah. Seems like you'd have somebody else appointed besides the crew that did the damage.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think Senator Schrader may recognize this language. Ombudsman typically is a person within the agency, actually. It's mediator that more often would be somebody outside. This language does conflate facilitator and mediator. It is what it is. Ombudsman is not uncommon. In fact, I think typically is within a particular agency or program.
I think, if I remember correctly, this was language that we adopted from our discussions that Senator Schrader had in a bill. So I don't know if Senator Schrader wants to share any more or not.
No, and I don't think there's any, be honest, full disclosure, I'm not wedded to it. It has to be an LCDC. The goal here is to be good, is to help people understand our complex system, and it is complex, and get things to yes, if possible, and be a friend of the citizens. So, that's the goal and the intent here.
Okay. Then we have sections 19... 23, which are on miscellaneous procedural issues. Any questions on those? Then the conforming amendments in section 24. Section 25, just a procedural caption reference, and section 26, the emergency clause.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Senator George.
What was the need for the emergency clause other than to stop couldn't we just enact a delay and then not have an emergency clause so the citizens could actually refer this if they wanted to?
The emergency clause gives the ability to actually have it implemented immediately, so individuals who have been hung up in the system can actually get going instead of waiting longer and longer. It also, by allowing for the transferability that's in the measure now, it gives clarity and gives those rights as compared to waiting where they don't have transferability at this point. So policy decision was to try to enact and move it immediately into effect.
Okay. Representative Clem.
This is a question back a little ways. Is that in order? Or no. If it's not, that's okay.
You've been very moderate in your question asking, Representative Clem, so why don't you double back?
For Representative Clem. Yeah, for me. Sorry. Just this is on the clustering part. And it might be a deeper policy discussion, as we kind of talked about. If a grower has 100 acres and now they decide to take the three houses and say they want to do it at 5 acres each, and we had talked about the policy effect of delaying that for potentially 10 years if or not. They can still sell the other 85 acres to a farmer who wants to farm it. They don't have to keep the whole tract intact, do they? They can carve off their three chunks and sell them, not develop them, but then go sell the rest to a farmer who just wants to farm and not build.
Well, that's actually what the policy is. It's basically isolating that area that's going to be, quote, unquote, developed and retaining the rest. And so once that designation's been made, the rest, we hope, it was going to be staying within the use of, in this case, farming, or if it was in forestry. That's the whole protection here, is to allow those individuals who want to develop to be able to do that, access it, but retain the continuity of the rest of the property. And that's why clustering maintains the greater opportunity to keep it for that designated use.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, that is correct. And in fact, in your example, the claim has gone forward, and what the claimant has obtained has been home sites, which, and this amendment authorizes the partition, the division of those home sites, and then the sale of those home sites undeveloped. And so that gets, I think, exactly to where you were going, that yes, indeed, those three home sites could be sold undeveloped, and the farmer continue to farm the other 85 acres or whatever remains.
Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
And if I could, Representative Clem, currently, under Measure 37, the way it currently is, the average is one house on 12 acres. And my argument has been is that the most productive farms are those farms that are smaller acreage, where people live on the farm and they get the highest use per acre off the farms. And so the smaller the farm, the more production you get per acre. So that's why I disagree with the policy, is because I think we ought to be encouraging more people to get into that high production agriculture, because that's the future of specialized crops. So that's the policy differential.
Any further questions from the committee? Well, if not, committee, thank you very much for laboring through with a lot of technical material. I am going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1019. That concludes our agenda for this evening. Committee, very much. We're adjourned.